In the beginning, there was Nun, the primal ocean of chaos. From these waters came Ra, the sun god, who gave birth to Shu, the god of air, and Tefnut, the goddess of moisture. Tefnut gave birth to Geb, the earth god, and Nut, the sky goddess. And so the physical universe was created. Against Ra's orders, Geb and Nut married. Ra was incensed and decreed Nut could not give birth in any month of the year. Tut, the god of learning, decided to help her, and gambling with the moon for extra light added 5 extra days to the 12 months, the 360 days. And on those 5 days, Nut gave birth to Osiris, the lord of the afterlife, Horus, Set, the god of chaos, Isis, the goddess of magic, and Nephthys, who seduced her brother Osiris to produce Anubis, the jackal god of embalming. Men were created from Ra's tears, different nations from different tears. When they rebelled and were ungrateful, Ra and a council of gods decided to destroy them. Ra created Sekhmet, the lion-headed goddess of war, to do that job. She was efficient and slaughtered all but a few humans until Ra relented and tricked her into stopping. So went the creation stories of the gods of Egypt. They were the pictures and the myths that filled the heads of God's people Israel as they lived and laboured in Egypt. It informed them. They informed them about the way the world was and who they were as they played a part in it. They were stories of chaos and rage and selfishness, of tricks and war and anger, of many gods rather than one god, gods who were born and who represented the sun and the moon and the oceans and the rivers and the land rather than the God who made them. They were stories about gods who made mistakes and who made decisions without purpose or wisdom or planning, gods who were callous and brutal and vindictive. And so life for humans was about trying to please all of these different gods, trying to trick them or force them into giving you a good harvest or a safe birth or success at war or protection from drought or flood. Never sure whether you were sacrificing to the right god or whether another more powerful god might come along and change the plan. They were the creation myths that might have been influencing Israel back then. But we have creation myths that are just as significant, that manipulate us to think and act in certain ways, myths that tell us what our purpose is and the purpose of the world, telling us what the world is like and where it's headed. The universe began with a big bang. It'll end with a giant implosion, out of which a new universe might form. There's no end, there's no beginning, just a continuous cycle. There's no progression. The world isn't headed anywhere. It's all just a matter of chance, physics, matter, planets, stars, and energy. Even life itself. Give it long enough and atoms will become molecules, which become amino acids, which become proteins, which become DNA, which become life. And then unicellular organisms become multicellular organisms, which become eventually self-aware, thinking life forms. There is no purpose. There is no design, no plan. There's no right and wrong. The fittest survive. Humans are nothing more than smart monkeys with less hair and better manners. Which means that your purpose in life is to survive, to find the best genetic material in a partner, to reproduce and pass on your genes to the next generation. The idea of a soul of beauty and love, compassion, trust, loyalty, honesty, they're nothing more than chemical reactions in your brain. Right and wrong, good and evil, just depends on your point of view. And when you die, well, that's just the end. It's all part of the cycle. Your body is eaten by worms and it feeds the next generation. Your energy spreads into the universe and the universe slowly runs down. They're the creation myths in our godless society. They're bombarding you. Media, schools, universities, science, TV, newspapers. And so we need to hear some truth. Israel needed to hear some truth. Truth about God and his universe and about us. About what God is like and his world and about the part we play in it. Truth that answers the big questions. Why am I here? What's eternity? Who's God? How can I know him? That's exactly the answers we get when we turn to Genesis 1. Answers to the question, to questions about the God who made the world, about the world God made and the man God made. So firstly, the God who made the world. It's right there in the very first sentence of the Bible. In the beginning, God was. It's the subject. He's the subject of the whole book, the subject of the whole universe. It's God himself. And he's a God who's eternal, who always was. He had no beginning. Unlike the false gods of Egypt and the nations, God is the only being who exists outside of time and space. But he didn't stay outside of time and space. He entered it. He created it. He created time and matter and energy. It all came into existence at the command of his word. He spoke the universe into being out of nothing. Now, at this point, I want to stop and think about the style of literature we have in Genesis 1. You don't have to look too deeply to realise there's something unusual about it. The main thing we notice is that it's very structured. If it's not poetry, it's close. Perhaps like song lyrics. There are regular sections, and each one begins the same, and God said. And each one ends the same, and there was evening, and there was morning, the day. There's a rhythm to the whole chapter. It's one thing to notice it, it's another to work out its purpose. Why? What's the purpose of writing in this way? What's the purpose of this pattern? Well, here's what I think. The rhythm and the pattern in the story reflect the rhythm and the pattern in God's world. They reflect the design and the order. The rhythm and the pattern of the story reflect something about God himself. When God creates, there's nothing random or confused or half-baked about it. It's considered. It's intricately planned. He brings wisdom and detail and harmony to his work of creating. And what's more, God enjoys what he's made. From day three onwards, he looks at what he's made and he declares it good. We don't hear any of that in the Egyptian creation myths. This is a picture of God that's far removed from the pagan gods of the nations like Egypt. Or even what the world today says about God. He's one God, not many. There's no confusion about which God. He's eternal. He's infinitely powerful. He's wise and ordered. He's not fickle or changing. He's always faithful to what he says and to who he is. And since he enjoys what he's made, it seems there's the possibility that mankind can actually please a God like this, rather than constantly living in fear of wrath, of being nothing more than a splinter in God's finger, a grain of dust in his eye that just annoys him. Seems like God might actually be able to be known More on that next week and the week after. So that's the world that God made. Sorry, that's the God who made the world. What about the world God made? Well, the big picture is that the world began in disorder and it finished in order. Verse 2 says that the earth was formless and empty. It was shapeless and bare. Imagine a blank canvas. And then God begins to work on that shape. Day one, he speaks and light and dark come into being. He calls one day, the other night. Day one ends, evening, morning. Day two, God speaks again and sky and water are separated, the waters above from the waters below, and day two ends, evening and morning. Day three, more work tracing out the form, adding shape. He speaks and the land separates from the water and mountains rise out of the oceans. And God declares that good. But he's far from finished. He's only halfway. He speaks and plants rise out of the soil. Great forests and fields of grass, bushes and shrubs and fruit trees. And finally, the formless has form. The shapeless has shape. The canvas has been covered. It's a wash of colour and outline, of silhouette and shadow. And God declares it good. Day three ends, evening and morning. He's halfway there. Well, next God comes to each aspect of that creation and he fills in the details. There's form and shape, but it's empty. Now's the time to fill up what's empty. Time to get out the fine brushes. Day four, he speaks, and the sun, moon and stars blaze across the sky and fill it up. They fill up the night and the day. God declares it good. Day four ends, evening and morning. Day five, he speaks, and the oceans and the skies are now full. They teem with life, fresh water, salt water, mammals and fish, squids and crabs, seed-eating birds, birds of prey, huge whales, tiny honey-eaters. Vacant becomes full to overflowing, and God declares it good. Day five ends, evening and morning. Day six, the painting is nearly finished. God moves onto the land. There's soil and trees, there's mountains and valleys, deserts and forests. They've got shape, but they're blank, they're empty. And so God speaks and the land produces animals. Running, jumping, waddling, crawling animals. Digging, climbing, wriggling animals. Animals that hunt and chase, and animals that hide and are chased. Animals that wander, animals that set up homes. Animals that live in herds or communities, others that live alone. And God saw that it was good. From the God of order and design has come a world of order and design, a world of variety and complexity and colour, but a world where each part fits together perfectly, just the way it was designed, everything in perfect balance. From the enormous patterns of the Milky Way, the splashes and swirls of stars and constellations across millions of light years, to the tiny, unique designs of a snowflake. From the balance of mass and gravitational attraction that keeps the Earth orbiting just the right distance from the sun so that water stays liquid and life is possible, to the balance of mass and energy and charge that keep atoms stable, that keeps negative electrons orbiting a positive nucleus without ever collapsing, making matter possible. From the macro to the micro, there's precision and detail and careful planning. But God isn't finished yet. He's got one last piece of creating to do, and this is the pinnacle. A creature like himself, bearing his likeness, who can care and cultivate and rule his creation under him, who can enjoy his creation with him. And so he makes man. Verse 26, God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Here's mankind, the only creature with a touch of divinity, made in God's likeness, made to recognise him, made to understand eternity, to appreciate and enjoy his creation like God himself, but also with a task like God's, made for a purpose, made to look after the creation, to care for it, to rule, God says, to use his creation. We'll see more of that next week. And now the last piece of the picture is in place, and God stands back from his painting, and like an artist, he holds up his thumb and he declares, "Very good." It's a picture of perfection, of God and his people and his world in perfect harmony and unity and relationship. It's a picture that's summed up in the first box in the Two Ways to Live presentation. You may have seen this presentation before. There's a picture and it says, God is the loving ruler of the world. He made the world. He made us rulers of the world under him. In that one paragraph, the answers to all the big questions in your life are answered. Who is God? He's the loving ruler of the world. Who am I? I'm made by God. I'm made to be, to rule the world under him. Why am I here? And so we realise that we have a purpose. The world was designed and created for a reason. We're significant, we're important and precious. There's a reason why we feel love, justice, loyalty, loneliness, beauty. We experience those things because we're made in God's image, like no other creature. We're made for relationships. We're made for God. And we have a job to be getting on with. We were made to rule, to care and nurture and use and enjoy God's world. How well is humanity doing at that? But more on that in a couple of weeks. And yet for all its beauty and perfection, that's not all there is to God's world. For all man's purpose and identity and significance, he's actually made for something else. For all creation's completeness, that's not the end goal, because there's still one more day. Creation's finished, but that's not the end. Chapter 2, verse 1 says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work, and God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he'd done." We've seen a pattern of six, but it doesn't finish at six, it finishes with seven. The culmination of creation is not man, or even the complete creation, with man as God's second in command, even though that's all very good. The culmination, the finale, is rest. That's the target. Holy rest. Rest that's set apart from the rest of the work of creating. Rest that shows that creation is complete, with nothing else to add. It's not half finished. And it's rest which is more than just doing nothing. It's rest which is an active rejoicing in what's been created. For God to step back and to hold up his thumb and to enjoy. And as we keep reading through the Bible, we see that God's resting is a pattern for the way we should rest. One day in seven, to pause, to rest, to enjoy the creation and to enjoy the Creator, to participate in God's rest. Did you notice there's something missing from the description of day seven? It's there for every other day. There's no closure. There was evening and morning the seventh day. We don't see that. Because day seven is continuing. We're living in day seven. God calls us to live in the rest of being connected to Him, enjoying Him, enjoying His creation. But I think there's at least one other thing we can say about God's rest, and that is that it's rest that points to something else. Creation is there in the first 6 days, but God's goal is something beyond 6 days, something beyond His creation, His world. As we keep reading the Bible, we learn something else about rest, that God is planning another rest, rest that is outside of this creation. Hebrews 4 promises God's eternal rest, something that's still in front of all of us, something that we haven't entered yet, something to look forward to, something to persevere for. Hebrews 4 says, "Therefore, since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it." But then down in verse 9 it says, "There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God, for anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest." Yes, there's an eternal rest, but there's also rest that begins now as we grow in our relationship with our Creator, connected by his Son Jesus. As we learn to trust him and enjoy him and obey him and rely on him. That's rest we can begin now, but it's only fully experienced in eternity when God's new creation begins. A perfect, complete, intimate, eternal creation. And that brings us comfort for the frustration when we look at the world around us and we see it bears little resemblance to God's perfect world. When we see pain and suffering and death and frustration, and we wonder where God is in all of those things. Because as perfect as it was at the beginning, that's not the way the world is. And this world isn't all there is. And so we hope for another world. But as we rest in this fallen, broken world, let's keep our eyes on Jesus. He's the key to real rest. He's the one who leads us into true rest. Matthew 11:28, he says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart. You will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." So let's make every effort to enter the rest that Jesus offers, to rejoice in our Saviour, to rejoice in our Creator and in his creation, and live as people with purpose and joy and love, people who know who we are and where we're headed. Let's pray.